Chapter 7. Raven opened the door of the apartment to admit Dev Cooper.
Dev, what is it? Have you heard from Steele?
Pack, he said, brushing past her.
What?
I said pack, he repeated urgently. Pack your things. We haven't got much time.
Pack my things? I don't understand. What is this? What's going on?
Listen to me, he said, grabbing her by the shoulders. Higgins just called me a little while ago. Carmen's found out about the Matrix and about Steele taking off on us. It's hit the fan.
Senator Carmen,
she said, looking confused.
But how could he?
Jennifer Stone went to him and told him the whole story. She sold us out. Carmen just had Higgins up before the damn committee. They're shutting down Project Steele and taking over Download. There's probably an order going out for my arrest right now. What's more, Carmen's putting out an APB on Steele.
What? That's crazy. Why?
The official story is that Steele's malfunctioning, and both the Metro Police and Strike Force are being mobilized to bring him in. If he won't come in voluntarily, they've got orders to take whatever steps are necessary to neutralize him. You understand what that means?
Holy shit. I don't believe it.
Believe it? Higgins is on his way over here right now. Where does Steele keep his gear, his weapons, and his battle mods?
In the arms cabinet. Over there.
I'll take care of it, said Cooper. Pack your stuff.
I don't have any suitcases.
Take whatever you can and wrap it in a fucking blanket, girl. Use pillowcases, anything. But get your shit together. Move it. Without another word, she ran into the bedroom. Dev went over to the arms cabinet and opened it. He started taking out Steele's battle mods, the modular appendages, and the special belt they attached to, the guns and spare magazines and the holsters, dumping it all out on the floor and taking a quick inventory. If he forgot anything, there'd be no chance to come back for it. Outside, he heard the sounds of a chopper coming into the penthouse helipad. Moments later, Higgins and two of his agents came in through the sliding glass doors. That all the stuff? Asked Higgins. I think that's all of it, Cooper replied. Higgins checked it all over quickly. Okay, it's all here. Sharp, Foster, pack it up. Agents Sharp and Foster started packing the gear away as quickly as they could in a couple of large duffel bags. Where's Raven? Higgins asked. In the bedroom, getting all her things together, Cooper said. Hell, it'll take her all day, said Higgins. Sharp, go help her. Sharp grabbed one of the spare duffels and went into the bedroom. How much time we got? Asked Cooper.
I don't know, Higgins replied. But Carmen will probably move fast. I've got King and Mattson over at your place packing your things. They're just going to take some clothes and a few personal effects, plus your notes and records. Whatever they think's important.
My notes and records are the only things that matter, Dev said. Where are we going?
You'll find out when we get there.
Sharp, let's move it!
The bedroom door opened and Sharp came out with Raven. He was carrying a duffel filled with her clothing. Foster had already gone out to load Steele's gear in the chopper.
All right. You know what to do? Asked Higgins.
Stay here and wait for word from ICE, said Sharp. If he calls, let him know what happened. Otherwise, alert security downstairs and stay in touch with the units outside so they can pick him up before he comes anywhere near the building. If anyone else shows up and tries to get in, stall.
Right. Said Higgins. Another chopper should be coming in about 5 minutes. I'll have it standing by on the pad outside. If you can't stall them any longer, get out of here. I don't want them arresting you for obstruction.
Got it.
Okay, let's move.
Wait, where are we going?
Raven asked.
I've got no time for explanations, Higgins said. If you want to help Steele, shut up and do what you're told. Now, come on, let's move it.
You've got to be kidding me,
said Jake Hardesty with disbelief.
It's no joke, Jake,
the commissioner said over the phone.
This comes right from the top. You're to mobilize all units to find Steele and bring him in. And if he won't come voluntarily, your orders are to take whatever steps are necessary.
What the hell does that mean?
I don't think I have to spell it out for you, do I? Jake.
Commissioner, I'm going to insist you spell it out,
said Hardesty with an edge to his voice. There was a brief, uneasy silence.
All right, Jake, I owe you that much at least. He was one of your people. If Steele resists arrest, use of deadly force is authorized.
Jesus Christ! Said Hardesty. Sir, I'd like to know who gave you that order!
I'm giving the order, Jake.
You know what I mean!
Hardesty replied.
Who's leaning on you?
You're out of line, Jake.
Don't give me that! Damn it! I've got the right to know! Is Higgins behind this?
I told you, Jake. This order comes down from the top. I've got it from the mayor, and he's got it direct from Congress.
Congress? You mean Bryce Carman, don't you?
You can draw whatever inference you like,
the commissioner said.
The point is, you've got your orders.
If I give an order like that to my people, I'm liable to have a mutiny on my hands,
said Hardesty.
In that case, I suggest you remind them of what happened with the other cyborg,
the commissioner said.
What proof do we have that Steel's malfunctioning?
Asked Hardesty.
None of the units have reported anything! There's been no word from the street!
We can't afford to wait for that,
the commissioner replied.
And the decision isn't mine to make, Jake. I've got my orders, too. Steel has disappeared. Word is, he's acting erratically, and when he encountered a Metro unit that gave him orders to come in, he refused. If he goes off the deep end the same way Stalker did, we're gonna have a real mess on our hands. If that's the case, then remember that it isn't Steel anymore, but a machine that's out of control. A very dangerous machine. He's got to be brought in, and if he won't come in, he's got to be stopped.
God damn it!
Hardesty said.
What does Higgins have to say about this?
Not that it's any of your business, but it's out of his hands,
said the commissioner.
Project Steel's been ordered shut down, and downloads been taken away from the agency due to flagrant security violations and an attempt to cover them up. I wouldn't want to be in Oliver Higgins' shoes right now. Or Dr. Cooper's, for that matter. I've just issued orders to Metro to have him brought in on charges of criminal conspiracy. The whole thing's a mess, and Steel's right smack in the middle of it. Find him, Jake. Find him and convince him to come in quietly, for everybody's sake.
The commissioner hung up the phone.
Jesus fucking Christ!
Said Hardesty. He slammed down the receiver. Steel stared at the naked woman asleep beside him in the bed. He thought of Raven. It was the first time he had ever been unfaithful to her. Not that they had ever been promised to be faithful to each other. They had never even bothered to strictly define their relationship. They had simply taken things one day at a time, and it had seemed to work out that way. Raven had felt threatened by Donna, the ghost. He wondered how she'd feel about Donna as a reality. Strangely, he didn't feel guilty. He felt as if perhaps he should, but he didn't. What had just happened had seemed right, somehow. It had felt right, two people reaching out to one another, trying to establish contact, to find reassurance and some kind of meaning, each trying to lay their ghosts to rest. He looked down at Donna's body, so different from Raven's. Fuller, softer, more mature. She had made love differently, too. With Raven, it was always very passionate and energetic, even better than it had been with Janice. And he had not thought that it could be better than it had been with Janice. But with Donna, it had been different. They had started off slowly, with great tenderness and a certain hesitancy, as if neither of them were really sure what they were doing. Donna had never taken her eyes from his. There had been a desperate intensity in her gaze, a longing, a searching. And behind it, clearly mirrored, there was so much pain. It startled him how familiar and natural it felt. He knew her and he knew her body as if he had made love to her 1,000 times. When they kissed, her full, pliant lips gently tasting his, it felt unbelievably familiar. Yet he'd never even touched her before. It was an incredible sensation. He knew the precise spot on her neck where she liked being kissed, knew exactly how it affected her when he took her erect snip. Okay. When he took her erect nipples between his lips and gently sucked on them, touching them ever so lightly with his teeth. He knew how to run his fingertips gently down the curve of her spine, tracing the vertebrae down to the small of her back and pressing her buttocks up against him. It was like a well-choreographed dance with an old lover as they lay locked together on their sides facing one another, her eyes wide and staring at him. Marveling at his knowledge of her, stunned at a complete stranger making love to her exactly as her husband had once done. He had caught himself doing it,
and thought to do it differently, afraid of the effect that it would have on her. But she had realized what he was thinking and had stopped him by placing her fingers up against his cheek and shaking her head, saying softly, "No, don't stop." And he knew precisely what she meant. He had realized that just as he was trying to connect with her and to resolve his doubts and his uncertainties, to experience a vital part of his past for the first time, so she was trying to do the same. In a way, she was finally saying goodbye to Jonathan, to his memory, which had haunted her as her memory had haunted Steele. He never had the feeling that she was trying to pretend she was making love with Jonathan. He was intensely aware of her being with him, with the stranger named Donovan Steele, who was, in a surreal way, both a stranger and an old lover. She kept looking up at him and touching him, exploring his body with her fingertips as if to reassure herself of his reality. And at the same time, he had the sense that she knew Jonathan was there as well, or at least a part of him was, as if she were making love to two men in the same body. He had moved on top of her and raised her legs up, gently kissing her ankles and the insides of her calves, and then he had placed her legs over his shoulders and entered her, penetrating deeply as she gasped and closed her eyes and softly said, "Oh God!" She kept saying, "Yes! Oh yes!" as he moved inside her until she shuddered violently and exploded in multiple orgasms, making a low, keening noise way back in her throat. Then she brought her hands up and cupped his face, pulling it down to her and kissing him deeply, with astonishing fervor, with the desperation of someone who had been alone and hurting for a long, long time. Afterward, they lay on their sides facing one another, simply staring into one another's eyes as she gently stroked his cheek and he caressed her. It seemed that words needed to be said, but no words would fit, and they both knew that. The moment was too fragile. Speaking would only break the spell. After a while, she closed her eyes and fell asleep, nestled up against him. Steele remained awake, puzzled at the way he felt. He felt neither guilt nor regret, but a profound contentment and a great sense of relief. She was real to him now. Together, they had both completed something. Something that had been incomplete and unresolved in each of them, in different ways, for a long time. Steele did not know how he knew, but somehow he was certain that the nightmare in the park would never trouble him again. Jonathan's past and Donna's past and his own past had all merged. There were no more unanswered questions. The specters had been laid to rest. Would Raven understand? He thought she would.
"Who is she?"
Donna said. He glanced at her, startled. She was lying there, awake and watching him.
"What?"
"The girl you're thinking of. Who is she?"
"Her name is Raven."
"It's a pretty name."
"She's a pretty girl, in a hardened sort of way," he added.
"Hardened? Why do you say that?"
"She hasn't had a very easy life."
"Tell me about her."
"You ever hear of the Borodini Enclave?"
"The settlement controlled by the crime family in Long Island?"
"That's the one, out in Cold Spring Harbor. She was born there. I don't really know much about her family. What happened to them, I mean. She was orphaned at an early age, and she never talks about it. There are a lot of things she never talks about."
Donna nodded with understanding. She knew about hurt held inside.
"When she was about 14 or so, she caught the eye of Tommy Borodini."
"Victor Borodini's son? The one they used to call Tommy B?"
"That's him. He must have been about 28 at the time. Tommy always liked them young. Anyway, he took her in. They became lovers, and she became a part of the family. The inner circle. Apparently there was talk of marriage, but I don't know how serious it was. For Tommy, I mean. It was serious for Raven. She loved him. And then one day she caught him with another girl. One of her friends. She walked in on them and Tommy made a joke of it. Wanted her to join them and make it a threesome. There was an argument and he struck her. She cut him with a knife. Slashed his face. You don't do that to Tommy the Bug. He beat her half to death, then turned her over to some of his goons. Sat there and watched while they raped her."
"My God!"
"It gets worse. After they were through with her, he had them drive her to the city, out to no man's land, up north in Harlem, and turn her over into a sadistic pimp named Rico. part of their prostitution operation. Rico turned her out, made her a part of his stable of hookers.
Jesus, couldn't she run away?
It's not that easy, Steele said. For one thing, she had nowhere to go. She didn't know anybody in the city. For another, she had been brutalized, and Rico kept her at his place for a while, until she looked presentable enough to turn tricks. And he worked on her all during that time. I've seen it more often than I care to think about. The players, as they call themselves, like to boast that there's no defense against a master pimp. They may be right. In their own primitive way, they're experts at brainwashing. They take impressionable young girls, girls who are vulnerable, and systematically destroy their personalities, strip them of their dignity, make them feel worthless and dependent. You'd be surprised at how easily it can be done.
No, said Donna quietly. I don't think I'd be surprised.
Rico kept her for some years, continued Steele, but she always gave him trouble. Part of her had never completely submitted to him. She never forgot what Tommy did to her. She held on to that, nurturing that memory, cherishing it in sort of a perverse way, letting it grow cold and hard inside her. Someday, somehow, she was determined to get even with him. She kept rebelling against Rico. He kept sending her out to trick for some pretty twisted Johns, and she got hurt. She hurt a few of them back, cut them with a knife. Rico finally decided to cut her loose, but he couldn't get any other pimp to take her. They all knew she was trouble, so since he couldn't turn a profit on her, he gave her to the Skulls to use and discard when they'd have her had their fun. The night we met, me and my partner, Ice, were conducting a raid on one of Bordini's warehouses. The Skulls were working for him. They had Raven in the warehouse, and they were gang-raping her. We pulled her out of there, took care of the Skulls and Bordini's men, then blew off the warehouse. She'd been worked over pretty well, and I wanted to take her to the hospital, but she refused. I suppose I could have taken her there anyway, but I figured she'd been through enough, so I took her home with me. He smiled. The first night, she tried to kill me.
To kill you? Donna asked with astonishment. After you saved her from that gang?
Sounds strange, doesn't it? Said Steele. But it made sense in a way. I sort of expected it. After I brought her home and she got cleaned up, she tried to show her appreciation in the only way she knew how. When I didn't take her up on it, she figured me for a sucker. And in her world, suckers deserved everything they got. You're either someone who takes or someone who gets taken. So after I went to bed, she decided to rip me off. I heard her rummaging around and went to confront her. She'd gone through my things and opened up my gun cabinet. She had a pistol, would have used it on me too, only I can move a bit faster than most people. Took it away from her. Then she came up with a knife, took that away from her too. Told her if she didn't behave herself, I'd break both of her arms. I told her to put all the stuff back where she found it, go back to bed and not give me any more grief. Then I gave her back the gun and the knife, turned my back on her and went to bed.
Weren't you afraid she might shoot you?
Donna asked, eyes wide.
Not really. For one thing, if she had, she probably wouldn't have done much damage. I can take a bullet, unless it's an armor-piercing or incendiary. But I didn't really think she'd shoot me. I'd thrown her a real curve. If I'd slapped her around, as she expected, it would have only reinforced her concept of the way the world worked. Except I didn't do that. I told her what would happen if she forced my hand, and she knew that I meant it. But I offered her an option. An option she hadn't been offered before. An option to take responsibility for her own options, her own choices. It was a gamble. It might not have worked, but I had the feeling that it would. After what she'd been through, somebody owed her something. A chance, an opportunity to make a choice. She took it.
He paused, staring off into the distance.
Then, later on, I had a nightmare.
He glanced at her.
The one I told you about.
Donna nodded.
I've had it too,
she said.
I know. I woke up from it, and Raven was there, holding me, telling me that it would be all right. She said she knew what it felt like. She had nightmares too. We talked about it. I think it was the first time I ever told anybody about my dreams. That threw her a bit too. She thought it took a real man to admit he was afraid. I told her it took a fool not to admit it. Anyway, I figured the next day I'd get her some clothes, give her some money, and let her go. Most likely, she'd only wind up right back where she'd been before, but there was a chance she wouldn't. Only if she found out that Ice and I were after Borodini, and she saw her chance to pay Tommy back for what he'd done to her. That was when I found out the whole story. Since she'd been in the Enclave, actually lived in the mansion, she knew things that could help us. The price for telling us was that she got to go along with us for the ride. To make a long story short, we took down the Borodini Enclave. Victor Borodini and his son Polly got away. We had to trade them and our other prisoners for some hostages Rick Borodini had, but Tommy didn't make it.
Did she?
No, she never got the chance. Tommy and his brother Rick were holding the hostages at another location. When we took the Enclave, we offered to trade Tommy's father and Polly for the hostages. Tommy didn't give a damn. He was perfectly willing to let his father and Polly rot for all he cared. He was going to kill all the hostages and take over what was left of the family. His brother, Rick, didn't see it that way. So he shot him. Some family, huh? Anyway, Raven and I have been together ever since.
That's an amazing story, Donna said. And I've been feeling sorry for myself because I thought I had it rough.
Raven never really felt sorry for herself, said Steele. But then she never lost her children. She only lost herself. She's been through some pretty rough times, but in ways, you've had it a lot rougher, he hesitated. I know what it's like to lose a child. It's hard. It's the hardest thing that there is. It's a pain that never goes away. Not ever. But you'll learn to live with it.
I never thought I could before, she said. But you're right. It's better to feel the pain than to not feel anything.
He looked down at her and smiled, then took her hand.
You should go back to her, she said.
I'm afraid to.
Because of what you said, that you might be having trouble with your mind?
He nodded.
You weren't afraid to be with me.
I had to be with you.
You have to be with her now. She needed help once and you gave it to her. Give her a chance to help you now.
What about you?
She smiled, sat up, and put her arms around his shoulders.
I'll be all right now, she said, kissing his neck. You gave me a chance to grieve. I've never really been able to do that before. And you showed me what it's like to feel again. I'm not afraid anymore. I'll never forget you, Steele. If you ever need me for anything at all, I'll be here. But what you need right now, I don't think I can give you. I'm not strong enough. But Raven is.
Jonathan really was a fool, said Steele.
Jonathan is dead. We've both got lives to lead.
She kissed his cheek.
Are you going to tell Raven about me?
Yeah.
Good. I think she'll understand. Tell her I said she's a very lucky girl.
Talk to me,
said Ice.
It don't look too good for your friend Steele,
said Slim, a wizened old black man with grizzled stubble and a voice that sounded as if someone had punched him in the throat. He wore a battered old leather car coat and a floppy leather cap, frayed polyester slacks, and foot gear known as PFCs, or Puerto Rican Fence Climbers, short black suede laced demi-boots with 8 eyelets, pointy toes, and Cuban heels. He looked like any other gypsy cab driver in the city, but there was a great deal more to Slim than meets the eye. He was, despite his appearance, one of the wealthiest and most successful pimps in No Man's Land, an independent who didn't have to give a cut of his action to the other gangs because, in his younger days, he had been the leader of the Skulls. He was also a veritable font of information. Few things went on in No Man's Land or Midtown that Slim didn't know about. He had a lot of connections, and he knew where all the bodies were buried.
What you got?
Asked Ice, sitting in the back seat of Slim's beat-up old cab.
The man done put an APB out on Steele,
Slim replied.
Word just hit the street. Citywide, Metro and Strike Force both done got orders to bring him in. And if he don't come quiet-like, they got the word to waste him.
Damn,
said Ice.
Anybody seen him?
I got the word out as soon as you called,
said Slim.
Steele been down in the old village. Had a run-in with a few lords who were trying to tear off some young snatch. Messed him up bad. Wasted the motherfuckers. They were seen going into some bar down on McDougal.
What bar?
Rick's Cafe,
said Slim.
We done headed down there now.
And then?
That's all, brother. Then he done dropped out of sight again. Man smart. He be staying low. What with half of the city looking for him?
Only he don't know they're looking.
I said.
Not with no shoot to kill all points bulletin.
He added, spitting the words out.
Man, I gotta have me a talk with Higgins. Find out what the hell's going on.
Your friend Steele's going down,
replied Slim.
If you don't turn himself in.
Not likely,
I said through gritted teeth.
If Higgins the one to put out that order, me and him gonna dance some.
You know a man named Dr. Devin Cooper?
Slim asked.
Yeah, Steele's shrink. What of it?
They're after him too.
Say what?
Heard it on the police band,
said Slim.
Man wanted for criminal conspiracy. Federal rap.
What the fuck?
Said Ice.
Find me a damn phone. Fast.
They were about halfway through Midtown, heading down toward the village. Slim pulled over to the curb in front of a restaurant.
Be right back. Keep the motor running,
Ice said. He got out of the cab and entered the restaurant. It was one of Midtown's fancier eateries, the kind that didn't have a menu posted in the window. An officious-looking maitre d' looked up as Ice came in.
I'm sorry, sir, he said. I'm afraid we can't seat you without a reservation, and our dress code stipulates a jacket and tie.
Phone,
said Ice.
I'm afraid we don't have a public telephone, sir. Our policy...
Ice grabbed the man under his arms and lifted him about a foot and a half off the floor, bringing him up to his eye level.
Wrong answer,
he said. The man's eyes bulged.
Certainly, sir. There's a telephone right behind the counter here. Please, be my guest.
Thank you kindly,
I said, lowering the man to the floor. He went around behind the counter, picked up the phone, and punched out the number for Steele's apartment. Sharp picked up on the first ring.
Steele residence.
Who the fuck are you?
Ice said.
That you, Ice.
Yeah, you one up on me.
This is Agent Sharp. I'd been hoping you'd call. I've got a message for you from Higgins.
Where's Raven?
She's gone, said Sharp.
What you mean gone? Where?
Don't come anywhere near this place. Far as I know, the police don't have any orders to pick you up, but there's no point in taking any chances. They haven't been here yet, but I expect them at any time. Have you found Steele?
No, I'm working on it. I'm going to a place called Rick's Cafe down the village, checking out a lead. I hear they got an APB on Steele.
So you know about that?
Yeah, I know. And Higgins got some explaining to do.
It wasn't Higgins,
Sharp said.
He's in the fire, too. It was Dr. Stone. She went to Carmen and sold the project down the river. Cut a deal with them to get herself put in charge of download after they take it away from the agency. It's already in the works. She told them that Steele is malfunctioning, just like Stalker. And she told them all about the Matrix, too. Raven is with Higgins and Cooper. They stopped by here and picked her up, along with Steele's gear. There's an order out for Cooper's arrest, and by now, they've probably got one out on Higgins as well. Find Steele if you can and let him know what's happened. I'm going to stay here as long as I can in case he calls in, but I may have to leave fast. The line should be secure, but I don't want to take too long in any case. I don't need any more aggravation, like that time I went to make that delivery, remember?
Ice frowned. The man was trying to tell him something.
You had some aggravation of your own about the same time, as I recall,
said Sharp.
Something about paying back an old debt, wasn't it?
Yeah,
I said. Sharp had been the bag man on the ransom for the hostages, taking Steele's place and stalling for time while they hit the Enclave on the island. Paying back an old debt, thought Ice. Getting back at Victor Borodini for putting a contract out on him.
I know what you mean.
Sometimes I wish we could go back to those times, troublesome as they were,
said Sharp.
Things just seemed a lot simpler then.
Yeah, I hear you.
Take care of yourself, Ice.
You too.
He hung up the phone. The maitre d' was nowhere in sight, having beaten a hasty retreat. Ice went back out to the cab and got in.
Now we go into that bar,
he said.
And step on it.
Rick's Cafe.
This is Lieutenant Donovan Steele.
Hey, Steele, old buddy, how you doing? It's Rick.
Hello, Rick. I'm just fine, thanks.
How things work out with the lady?
What lady is that?
That brunette you asked me to keep an eye out for. You know Donna, the one you left with here a while ago?
Oh, yes, of course. I'm sorry, my mind was somewhere else.
Listen, I'm sorry about that trouble you had with the guy who's annoying you. I know I threw him out after you left. Thought not to come back. I can't have people annoying you when you come in. I like to take care of my special customers.
Thanks, Rick. I appreciate that.
Anyway, I'm glad I was able to help you out with locating Miss Barrett. That was her name, right? I think I heard you call her that.
Barrett, right.
So anyway, what can I do for you?
I need a favor, Rick. A friend of mine named Aya should be down there in a little while. You can't miss him. Black, shaved head, about as big as a house. When he comes in, ask him to give me a call. I'll be at this number. Got a pencil?
Sure thing. Hold on a sec. Okay, shoot. Right. Okay. Got it.
Thanks, Rick. Tell him it's about the Matrix. He'll know what that means.
About the Matrix. Right. Got it.
Make sure he gets the message.
Will do. Take care of yourself, buddy.
You too, Rick. Thanks again.
Ice wasn't sure what to expect when he arrived at Rick's Cafe on McDougal Street, but the one thing he had not expected was to be greeted by name.
You must be Ice,
the bartender said as he came up to the bar.
We met,
said Ice, his eyes narrowing behind his shades.
Nah, I think I'd remember that,
the bartender said with a grin.
Name's Rick. I own this place. Steele's a friend of mine. He called a little while ago and said you'd be coming by. Asked me to give you a message. Said to call him at this number.
He handed Ice a slip of paper.
Said to tell you it was about the Matrix and that you'd know what that meant.
Yeah. How long ago he called?
Asked Ice.
Maybe about 5 minutes ago. You can use the phone in the office if you like. It's right through there.
Thanks.
Ice went into the small office, sat down at the desk, and dialed the number on the slip of paper. He didn't even hear a ring.
Hey, you, Ice?
Yeah, it's me, Matrix.
You knew it was me?
Had to be. Figured you was listening in on Steele's phone.
I told Raven I wouldn't, but the situation's changed considerably since then. Under the circumstances, I'm glad I was monitoring the line. It's nice to finally meet you, in a manner of speaking. My last memory of you was on the day I was shot.
Yeah, it'd be interesting,
said Ice.
How come you sound like Steele when you ain't got no throat?
In a way I do,
said Matrix.
I can access any number of audio and voice peripherals throughout the net. The first voice Def Cooper made for me sounded just like Steele's. In a sense, it's my voice too, so I figured I'd keep it.
You know what's going down?
I do. I've been monitoring the agency lines and the police band. I'm looking into the situation to see if there's anything I can do. In the meantime, it's important that we find Steele.
I hear that. Got any suggestions?
Try Donna Barrett, 311 Berry Street, apartment 4C. Steele was last seen leaving Rick's Cafe with her.
How you track her down?
Asked Ice.
Telephone and employment records,
Matrix replied.
You'd be surprised how easy it is to find things out if you know where to look and can access any data bank in the electronic net.
Handy,
Ice said.
Gives me an idea. You might want to see what you can find out about the Honorable Senator Bryce Carman. He the man put out the word on Steele.
I'll look into it.
How I get in touch with you? Call the same number?
That'll do,
said Matrix.
It's a city administration data bank access line. I'm keeping it monitored. It's also secure.
Got it,
Ice said.
I'll let you know when I check out that address.
Check in every now and then,
said Matrix.
I'll keep you posted on what's going out over the wires.
Right. Nice talking to you. Stay loose.
He hung up the phone. Weird, man, he thought. Very weird. Like talking to Steele, only it wasn't Steele. Not exactly, anyway. Donna Barrett, he thought. 311 Perry Street. Apartment 4C. Who the hell was she? No matter. In a little while, he'd find out. He went back out to the street and got into Slim's cab.
Perry Street,
he said.
Gotta see a lady.
End of chapter.